Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
My guest today is Debbie Cox. Debbie Cox is the Executive Director of the Jane Goodall Institute in Uganda, and she's put her life on the line many times to rescue chimpanzees in Africa and even evacuate them from war zones. Debbie is one of the world's foremost experts on the handling and the care and the conservation of these strange creatures that remind us of ourselves all the time whenever we see them play and eat and fight and laugh. Debbie was a zookeeper at Sydney's Taronga Park Zoo until she decided to live and work more closely with African chimps. And now she is at the Jane Goodall Institute in Uganda, where she set up two sanctuaries for our primatical cousins so they can at least have a semblance of life in the wild. Why does Debbie do this? Well, it's quite simple. It's obvious. She adores chimps. She physically embraces them when she meets them, and she's touched by how vulnerable they are to the modern world. Debbie Cox, hello.
Thank you for having me.
Jane Goodall was in last year, who told me a bit about the communication of chimpanzees. How long does it take you to learn and pick up those noises and communication skills of chimpanzees?
I don't think it takes you too long at all, really, because the chimps out of all of the apes have the most facial expressions other than humans, and the facial expressions are pretty much the same as humans. So most people, I think, can recognise whether they're happy or angry or they're afraid pretty quick. And their gestural language, it would be the same as if you had a child who hasn't yet spoken, you know, hasn't yet picked up spoken language. So you would sort of pick up those different things pretty quick.
Do the facial expressions get more complicated than that? Like, do they go beyond, you know, happy, sad, angry, hungry, whatever? Can they be like, you know, sneaky or puzzled or bemused?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the sneaky ones are always really cool to watch because, you know, it's got to be that subtle. Often it's just subtle eye contact. That's the one other thing about chimps. Orangutans and chimps both will give you direct eye contact, and it's not classified as being threatening as long as it's not a long-term stare, where gorillas never can you give them full-on eye contact. It's always sideways glances. So when you're doing direct eye-to-eye contact, you read so much more in the eyes than you really understand. You can pick it up when you're with a chimp and know exactly what's going on.
Does that mean they're socially a little more complex than other apes?
Well, chimps live in much larger communities. So chimp communities can be 100, 150 individuals. So that social complexity compared to orangutans, who are generally solitary. The biggest grouping is a mother with infants, and so she might have two or three, you know, like her infant and then adolescent and maybe a juvenile and adolescent offspring with her. That's about the biggest of a social grouping that you see with orangs. And then gorillas are in harems, so maybe up to 30 would be the biggest gorilla group you would find. So social complexity is very different when you're dealing with multiple families and you're dealing with individuals you may only see once a year, where with gorillas, they see each other every day.
I've seen video of you, Debbie, at I think it's in Tebbi Zoo in Uganda, where you're going to visit the chimps there that you're trying to actually have taken to a sanctuary. You love chimps? You go, you sort of embrace them. As soon as you walked in there, they sort of leapt into your arms and you were
there's no hug. Yeah, there's no hug like a chimp hug. If anybody ever wants, you know, when you always say, I need a hug, a chimp hug's the hug that you want.
What does it feel like?
Well, they really do hug you. They really hold you. They really embrace you. Where some people will, you know, put their arm around you, but they don't really hold you. And chimps really hold you. And they kiss the same as we do. I mean, as I said, a lot of their emotional expressions are exactly the same as us. So kissing is very important. Putting their arm around your shoulder when you're feeling not so good. Chimps do that to each other, and they'll do it to their human counterparts as well.
I might sound really urbanised and squeamish when I say that, but the thing that would worry me most about a chimp kiss would be the bad breath. Is it bad?
No, they've got a good breath.
They do?
Yeah. because they eat fruit all the time. So it's actually quite a good breath.
They're not so we're carnivals. The ones with the bad breath as far as they're concerned.
Exactly. And particularly milk. Milk gives you a bad breath.
And how do they grab you? They sort of put their arms...
right round you.
Right round you.
And they're
you.
Longer than ours. So the embrace is a much nicer embrace because they can really wrap themselves around you.
And what do they do with their heads? Do they look at you while they're embracing or do they like to nestle their head on your chest?
No, they normally nestle right beside you. Yeah, it's very, very nice. And they'll hold it for quite some time. Like if they're frightened or if they're upset or you're upset and they're trying to comfort you, it's a long embrace. You know, it's not just sort of a quick thing or like a social thing I have to do and then get away from it. That's not what it's about. It's very much an unconditional hug that you get.
Debbie, how old were you when you decided you wanted to work with animals?
Probably 10, I think.
10?
Yeah, I think about 10 I knew definitely my... you know, career would be with animals. And I think by the time I was like 12 or 14, I knew it was wildlife, not domestic animals.
Why?
Basically what happened was where everyone else was going and buying the magazines that had the pop stars in them, I was buying the wildlife magazines and taking the centerfolds out and putting them up on my wall. So I was the odd one out.
You know? Perving at leopards.
Yeah, exactly. Leopards and lions and giraffes. And I had all of those sort of animals were on my walls rather than horses. I mean, I had horses and I loved horses, but they still didn't do the same thing for me as wildlife did. And it was African wildlife that I kept being drawn to.
Sometimes when we're drawn to these things, we don't always really know why. What's at the bottom of that, do we? Do you think you might know what's going to persuade you away from pictures of David Bowie to get pictures of African wildlife instead?
I don't know. I think they're beauty. They just seem so perfect. Where sometimes I think humans aren't so perfect. And that I think I always have that admiration of watching them. They just seem to have evolved and are so perfect in their environment that when you see them there, like if you see a cheetah, even if a cheetah is walking or a cheetah is running, you have to be in awe of that individual and it's in the environment that it's in. It's just perfect.
It's part of the charisma with a cheetah and an animal like that, that all the decisions they make are very basic and simple and there's something quite black and white about the life of a creature like that.
Well, it's survival. They live at the edge all the time, and that's what it's about. And even for chimps, they're living at the edge. I mean, most Africans are actually living at the edge as well. And you actually have far more appreciation of life when you're in a place where life isn't guaranteed. Yeah, and I think that's the same. Like when you watch chimpanzees in their environment and you see them adapting to that environment, you know, they are amazing. I mean, they had people a couple of years ago who tried to be chimpanzees, you know, survive off the land the way chimps do, and they couldn't do it.
I've never heard of that experience.
Yeah, they tried it. I mean, they didn't even last a month in the forest, and you would think that they should be able to. So these were all Westerners. Now, of course, if they used forest people, they would just laugh at you, and of course they could survive. But these were all Westerners who thought that they were hardcore survivorists and they could do this, and they didn't last a month.
Debbie, you worked for a while at the RSPCA in Australia. Was that a distressing time for you?
It was. I came from a small country town of 800 people and I had worked at the local vet clinic in Leeton and I never saw any animal cruelty, so I was never exposed to that. And then when I went to work at the RSPCA, I mean, it was full on. You saw cruelty that you just could not comprehend. And so it was very stressful to do it. Plus it was... I think it's like working in an accident and emergency ward every day, and that's what we dealt with every day. Like when we got to work in the morning, you were just running all day. We were de-sexing 50 dogs a day. We were dealing with all these abandoned animals coming in. A lot of animals have to be euthanized because we just don't have enough space and there's not enough people to take them. So euthanasia was a part of that. I mean, at that time, I was there in 84 to 86, we probably averaged 50 to 100 animals a day had to be euthanized because we did not have the space to look after them. And that's terrible. I mean, when you see people just, you know, just dumping animals or not taking any responsibility, it's just, yeah, it's very stressful.
Did you get a bit dark on people after that experience?
I got hard. I went to work at the RSPCA because I needed to do a zookeeping course and I had applied to work at Taronga Zoo, of course, but, you know, you have to wait your turn and you have to keep applying many times over before you get in there. And the course I was doing, it was in the old days, we had to do 2 years animal attendance and then you did 1 year zookeeping. Today, I think it's just a 2 year zookeeping course and it specializes just in wildlife, where what I was doing was first domestic animals, lab animals, and then moving on to wildlife. And so only in the final year was I able to have any exposure or access to the zoo, because that's where they did all the classes, was actually at the zoo. And so once I got in there, you know, I badgered the head keeper of the primate section and he let me come in. So all my days off from RSPCA I spent at the zoo. And after 3 months, they offered me a job.
So why primates? Why not the other charismatic animals?
Primates and Australian mammals were the two animal groups that I was most interested in. Australian mammals I was interested in because I thought if I did Australian mammals, I could then travel around the world working in overseas zoos as a specialist in Australian mammals. And then primates because I was interested in primates. I think it's more that primates are so social and I enjoy that social interaction. I understand it. And some people work with primates, actually don't like working with primates. They take an aggressive interaction as a personal affront, like, you know, they're personally attacking you rather than the fact of that's just them being them and you're now in their territory, where if it was a bear doing it to you or a lion doing it to you, you would accept that because it's a predator animal and it has a right to do that. But for some reason, a lot of keepers take it a bit too personal and don't put it in its right context. And you do, and it's easy to do that when you see how similar they are, because all of the primates are very similar to us. And that was, I was good at doing, putting that in its box and just, you know, forgiving them for, you know, being pissed off at me at the moment and, you know, having a go at me, particularly like crab-eating macaques. We used to have to walk in with them and there's like 30 plus individuals, of which you'd have five adult males and you'd open up the door. We didn't have any holding areas. You had to walk in with them to clean and they'd be all standing there baring their teeth at you. And, you know, it's like, okay. And then, you know, you either back off or you take it as a bluff and you ignore them and you keep working. And after a while, they just let you go. But you have to know when is it a bluff and when they really mean business.
Did you ever get attacked by a bunch of macaques?
No, never by macaques. I did buy pygmy marmosets. They all jumped on the top of my head. I don't know what I did, but I obviously did something to offend them. And the whole five of them jumped on the top of my head. And I don't know if you've ever had these spiky little teeth in the top of your head.
But no, I haven't.
I know, and you can't swipe them because they're so little and you're just sitting there going, ow, 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 and you can't do anything. I just had to wait till they got over their hissy fit at me.
Debbie Cox is my guest in conversation. The first woman I can say, in all honesty, who's been in conversations, who's been bitten in the head by pygmy macaques.
Pygmy marmosets.
Pygmy marmosets, I should say. She's the executive director of the Jane Goodall Institute in Uganda, who's worked with chimpanzees and other primates, mainly chimpanzees, though, for many, many years now. Who were some of your favourite chimps there at Taronga Park Zoo? Do you remember them? Do you remember them, like, as individuals?
Yeah, very much so. Fifi would probably be the top. She was the matriarch of the community. Chimps in captivity are a little bit different to chimps in the wild, and I think it's a little bit different, like us living in an urban environment, in a well sort of endowed environment compared to a, maybe like hunter-gatherers. So females have a much bigger role in a captive setting and can actually be alpha. Where in the wild,
over the males.
Over the males, right. Which would never happen in the wild. And Fifi was that individual in many ways. She was really the number one. She was definitely the matriarch of all the females, but she also pretty much ruled over the males if they stepped out of line. But she was a peacemaker with it. She didn't do it by dominating over anybody. She earned everybody's respect. And, you know, I would watch two females who never liked each other, you know, having a spar with each other, and she would just go up and put her hand on each of their shoulders and they would just stop. And I mean, that power, you know, to be able to do that.
What did you think when you saw something like that? That's wild. That's
amazing.
Well,
you just like to learn what she does, you know, to be able to do that. Even in a human environment, you'd like to be able to just, you know, put your hands on two people and say, come on, let's calm down now. You know, we don't need to be fighting. You know, and she was good. She had a very high moral system. She like knew when it got too far or too much, and she would step in at that time. She was brave with that because she would take on these big males that were twice her size, and she was very elderly. But she also had her faults and flaws, and that was that she was an over-doting mother. She wasn't a very successful mother. She only had three offsprings that survived. And the last one, Fisher, was her daughter. And she totally spoiled her, totally doted on her. So even when Fisher...
No wonder she'd lost all the others.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Fisher at 7 and 8 years of age was the same size as Fifi, and she's still being carried around on her back. Poor old Fifi almost collapsed every time she was trying to walk around. But Fifi wouldn't make her get off. She would let her do it.
And I know a few human mothers like that.
I do. And when Fisher had her first baby, Fisher decided breastfeeding was okay, I could do that. But she really didn't want anything else to do with the baby. So she would just let the baby feed, then hand it over to Grandma and say, you look after it. And pretty much Grandma actually reared that baby. So watching that type of interaction going on, you go, wow, you know, there's a lot about, you know, human nature here, you know.
It's interesting you saying that there that Fifi could, you can have women who can be the alpha chimp in a group when they're in captivity. What happens to males in captivity if their role of hunter is not required? If they're not there,
they're not so much as hunters as they are protectors. They've got to protect the territory. And I think one of the things what is different is the fact that in captivity, most captive groups are maintained with a much smaller ratio of adult males than what you see in the wild. So the ratio is normally about 1/3. Of adult males should be in the community.
So, but they don't have a job then, do they? When they're in captivity,
they don't
males?
Need to. Well, and that's so they focus more on each other, and it's been a sort of a cycle that we've seen where we're only just sort of really still understanding chimps in chimp communities. Like when you think about it, the first lot of really long term studies came from Gombe. Well, Jane's communities were 50, so everyone thought 50 was the group size. And now in Uganda, in Kibale Forest, we have three groups that are at least 120 to 150. And now in Bodongo, we're seeing the same thing. So 50 is not the normal size. That may be different in Central Africa and West Africa. We don't know that yet. So, I mean, there's a couple of groups in Kibale where you've got 30 adult males together. And these guys, when they go out hunting, oh, my God, you know, it's scary just watching them. And, you know, where an average community who hunts may have one or two successes in a week, these guys have 8 success hunts in a day.
So they're organised.
Yeah. And you wonder, like, how far do they go in sizing before they collapse on each other? Like, how far can their social system work in size? We don't know that.
I'm just wondering. I know we shouldn't project human qualities too often onto these creatures, but is in captivity, is it a bit like a, you know, one of those towns that are full of sadly unemployed men? Do they men become listless and depressed? The males become listless?
They don't seem to. I think the main thing is they do become listless and depressed if there's not other males, and that's one of the big problems that we've seen, is that if you only have one male, adult male in the group, and young boys are coming up, then he's hammering them all the time because of their competition. Or he could be hammering the females because he's got no one else to, you know, have a go at. What we've seen in the sanctuaries, where the infants coming into the sanctuaries, it's pretty much a 50-50 whether it's male or female. So almost all of our sanctuary groups, we're running them into 40 individuals together, and we could have 10 to 15 adult males in a group. And we don't see the same levels of aggression as what we see in zoos. And yet we have more adult males together. And I think because they're too busy worrying about each other to worry about the females and to worry about any younger animals, individuals coming up, they're way more interested in each other. They're very social. Adult male chimpanzees are social animals, much more social than females.
So with that extra rivalry and competition, it's some kind of strange stability forms.
Yeah, exactly. Because they're busy worrying about each other. It's like, who's he trying to groom now? Who's he trying to get as his ally? Because that's what they're doing all the time. Because you can't be top dog on your own. You have to have allies to do that. So you're trying to get as many friends to help you as possible. And that's the interesting thing in the sanctuaries, because you haven't got brothers because you're all orphans. So you've got to build very strong relationships with males that are not your brothers.
Debbie Cox is my guest in conversation. She's the executive director of the Jane Goodall Institute in Uganda. She's lived in Uganda for some years, but your first posting overseas was Burundi.
Burundi, yeah.
You went there in 1994.
I actually went there in 93 first as a volunteer, and I was there for 4 or 5 months, and then I went back in 94 to take over the position as co-director.
Debbie, that's being in the wrong place at the wrong time, isn't it?
I arrived 2 weeks after the genocide started in Rwanda. And everyone sort of said, what are you doing going in there? I said, well, you know, someone has to go in. The chimps are there with nobody who understands chimps. So even if it meant going in just to euthanize them all and get out, someone had to do it because there was nobody there who could possibly do that. And being a veterinary nurse, I knew how to do that, and Taronga Zoo helped me out, providing me with the drugs if it came down to that, because we really didn't know how far what was going on in Rwanda was going to overflow into Burundi.
Well, the answer is quite a bit, isn't it? I mean, Rwanda is right on the border of Burundi, and Burundi had a fair bit of genocidal violence too, didn't it?
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's one of those silent ones in a way, is that most people don't understand that probably at least 500,000 people have died in Burundi over the last 10 to 15 years. It's very complicated trying to explain it to everybody, and everybody gets confused between the Hutus and the Tutsis and all this sort of stuff. But you basically have two countries with the same tribal makeup, with the same percentages. So both of them had 90% being Hutu and 10% being Tutsi. The difference being in Burundi is that after independence and their elected president was assassinated by the Belge, the military decided that they didn't want to lose the country, so they decided to do military takeover. So they had a military coup and they were going to run the country militarily until they felt stable enough. Well, of course, that just keeps perpetuating itself. So you'd have one coup after another about every 10 years. Another general thinks he can do a better job. And so you go through that same process again.
So there you are, Debbie, someone who's worked in Australia, and you're about to enter into this zone of genocidal violence. What are the chimps you went in to either rescue or euthanize? What chimps did you become aware of?
Well, I had been there already in 93, so all of the chimps and the staff, I already knew them. They're in a house, actually. We had what we called a halfway house, and it was the backyard of a house right near the airport, which was sort of a good place and a bad place in a way, because if rebels are going to come in, the first thing they want to take over is the airport. In some ways, we weren't in a great position, but in other ways, being right near the airport, if you had to evacuate out, was also handy.
Were they chimps who had been living in the wild, or were they in captivity?
Some of them, about 10 of them, had been in captivity for most of their lives, and some of them were newly brought out of the wild. Pretty much all of the chimps, bar one, came from the Congo. They did not come from Burundi. Burundians do not kill chimps. They do not eat chimps. They consider eating any wild animals is barbaric.
So there you are going into Burundi, and you came in today with your mum, yeah. Lucy. Did you tell your mum you were going into Burundi?
They all knew. They knew what I was doing.
You must have thought you were putting your life at risk.
Yeah, and you know, I did talk to them before that it was my choice and my decision, and that they shouldn't blame anybody if that happened. Probably by 95 it got worse, and we did have heavy fighting in Bujumbura for a couple of days, and at that point it looked like, you know, it could really happen. We weren't going to leave the chimps behind, so even though the US military were telling us, you know, you may have to evacuate out, of course their ruling is that they only take humans. So you make a decision to stay behind and then accept the consequences of whoever is going to be in charge and how they're going to react to you being there.
So going into Burundi, you made the decision to rescue these chimpanzees, if you could, or euthanize them if you couldn't. Mm. How did that rescue process then begin?
Well, the main thing is that we thought we were going to stay there. We thought that we could try to set up a sanctuary. So we were just sitting, waiting for you, Burundi, to stabilize out. But of course, it just continued to get worse. And so by the end of 94, we had made the decision that keeping them here, particularly the adults, was not a good option, because if we had to get up and move within a 24-hour period, I could not take the adults with me. The babies, you could. We could have stuck the babies in a boat, sailed down Lake Tanganyika down to Kigoma into Tanzania. With adults, we could not do that. So we really needed to get the adults out in a calm situation So we got the government to agree to let us move the 10 adults out to a sanctuary called Sweetwaters in Kenya.
Debbie, how? This is a country that's going through civil war with guns and machetes. The most appalling violence is being perpetrated.
You know, it was really interesting. We had he was then the foreign minister. We, you know, begged with them to let us do this, and they really didn't want this to happen. And we asked him to come out to see the chimps. And, of course, being in a very unstable situation, every minister, of course, had armed guards around them, as you can imagine. And he came out with probably a dozen soldiers. And, of course, the chimps all just freaked out when they saw these guys with their guns and in uniform.
They knew what guns were.
Yeah, absolutely. They were terrified. I mean, they'd all witnessed their mothers being killed exactly that way. So, of course, they were terrified. And they all reacted, you know, to that. And he's turned around and said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, they know what guns are. They've experienced their mothers being killed." So he told all of the guys to go back inside the house and stay out of view of the chimps. And then he came in, and then our adult male chimp, Poco, put his arm out like this. And he said, "What's he asking?" And I said, "He's asking you to, you know, reassure him that everything's okay." And he couldn't believe, and of course he went up to Poco, and Poco embraced him and through the bars, and he just went, "Okay, I'll sign whatever you want me to sign." You know, he just, I mean, he understood immediately, you know, what these chimps had gone through.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing the story of Debbie Cox. Debbie works in Uganda with the Jane Goodall Institute there. Before the headlines, Debbie, you were telling us how you persuaded the foreign minister of Burundi in the middle of civil war to meet with chimps at the airport, indeed embrace one of the chimpanzees there and agree to have them evacuated. That's all well and good, but how did you get this first lot of chimps out?
We had to have the crates built in Kenya, and they had to fly them across to Bujumbura, and then we had to get them there. We were told that the crates were there at the airport. We had to borrow a truck from the American embassy, and of course the man with the key was gone, wasn't he? This is a classic Africa tale, and the man with the key has disappeared. And so, you know, it was getting like 5 to 5, and, you know, the customs, you know, closed down directly on 5, plus everyone knew that we were going into what we call a ville morte, which is like a dead city, which means you don't travel outside of your compound during the weekend because there's going to be, you know, attacks and there's going to be burning vehicles and things like that on the road. So you just stay inside. You don't go anywhere. So here we are, like, waiting for this truck to be able to get these crates out, and we're supposed to be flying on Sunday. And if we don't get them out, we can't fly.
Yeah. And you could all be dead, quite frankly.
Well, and anything could be happening at that time. And then you've also got to go through flight clearances again, everything. You've got to do everything again. So it's not that easy. So finally the guy with the keys turned up. We got there at 1 minute to 5, and the guys are pulling down the roller doors, and we're just like, they're not going to let us get those crates out. And we were both, Ali and I, were sitting there begging these guys, please, 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 you know, knowing that we're going into a ville morte. And they finally gave up and pulled the doors back up, and we got all the crates out. Well, each crate was 200 kilos. So you imagine how many people you need to pick up a 200-kilo crate and stick it on the back of a truck, because we don't have forklifts or anything. Everything's done manually. So we eventually got the crates, and we got them back to the halfway house, and then the World Food Program offered to give us a truck to get the crates and the chimps back to the airport on Sunday. But then there was a delay with all the planes because there had been some unrest at the airport. So the planes actually delayed a day to come in. So that meant Monday. At the same time, we had the guy who was supposed to sign the CITES permit. So you can't, it's easier to move humans around the world than it is to move chimps. And so we have to have these very special permits to be able to move them around, and you have to have this signed. And, of course, the man who was supposed to sign it left the book, you know, at his office, which is in the middle of the country, not in the capital city. So then we had to drive him all the way into the middle of the country to get him to get the book to sign it.
There's this insistence on bureaucratic procedure in a country in civil war.
Yeah, but we got him to do it. You know, we drove him there, and we got it, and we got the what's name signed. Then at the same time, I'm back you know, at the ranch, so to speak, trying to prepare the chimps in the boxes. And the World Food Programme truck comes into our driveway and it bogs in the driveway. That took us another 5 hours to get the truck out. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, we're never going to get these chimps out, because here's my boss gone up in the middle of the country to get the piece of paper. I'm trying to get this truck and the chimps all ready for the next day. It was like every silly thing that could possibly go wrong was going wrong. And I'm thinking, you know, this is not supposed to happen. I've been giving a warning here that I shouldn't be doing this.
Did you despair? Did you?
I was very concerned, really. I mean, because I'm a vet nurse, I'm not a veterinarian, and I was about to knock down 10 chimpanzees, crate them up, and transport them across Africa to another place, and I'm taking that responsibility.
When you say knock down, you mean that
I have to anaesthetize them. I had to
sedate them.
Yeah, I have to sedate every one of them, and the only way I could do that is hand injections. We were doing everything that hadn't been done before, and to knock down 10 chimps in basically 1 hour, put them in boxes, and get them to the airport in less than 2 hours to get them on a plane and get them across to Kenya. You know, any zoo would just tell you you're crazy to even try to do that. Polly, who's the JGI director here in Australia now, she hadn't contacted me, you know, the whole time I was there. And that night she rang me up and I said, oh, Polly, I think I'm making a big mistake. I said, you know, I just can't believe how many obstacles are being put in front of us right now to get these chimps out, and maybe we shouldn't be doing this. And she said to me, no, it's always darkest before the dawn. She said, don't worry about it, you'll be fine and everything will go fine. And it did. It just went off like clockwork the next morning.
So the plan was to shift the chimps in several stages. You couldn't shift them all at once?
We shifted 10 at a time.
10 at a time. And when you finally got the crates on the truck, got the truck to the halfway house, got the sedated the chimps.
Yeah, so I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning because we had one chimp, Jojo, who was a very tricky chimp. And if I couldn't get her sedated, the chances are I wasn't going to get anybody sedated, because the other tricky part was that they're all jammed up in very small cages. And so I would have to knock down two or three chimps at the same time to be able to get them all out of the room together. You couldn't have one sedated and the other two walking around awake because you couldn't get the sedated one out. So you had to basically hand inject everybody pretty much at the same time, which meant I had to then train, you know, non-veterinary, nursing, non-medical people.
Go out there and sedate that chimp.
Pretty much, yes. You know, and trying to teach them that. So we're using oranges and that to teach them how to do injections and things like that. And we did it. I mean, it was just fabulous. It went off like clockwork, and 5 o'clock, by 7 o'clock, we were at the airport with all the chimps in the boxes. We had a great flight over, no problems.
When you say flight, what does that mean?
We were in a cargo plane.
And what is this? This was a large plane?
Or? Yeah, it's a big cargo plane. We were in, and they allowed me, because it's compressurized, I was allowed to stay at the back with the chimps. And the pilots just called me up to the cockpit as we were going past both Mount Kenya and Mount Kilimanjaro. Were both clear skies, and you could see both the mountains on either side of you, which was stunning. You know, and then we flew into Nairobi, and then we put them onto trucks, and then we drove to Sweetwaters.
What would have happened if any of those chimps got out of their cages, I wonder, in the plane? Do they mind for it?
Yeah, well, that would have been a problem, but it wouldn't have happened with those crates were very solid crates. The next trip I had to do, which was with the younger ones, that was a far more scarier trip, because we had to use an executive 9-seater Cessna, because the airport had been attacked so many times that no commercial flights were coming into the airport.
How do you get 10 crated chimps into a Cessna?
Well, we used, you know, the sky kennels, the pet packs that you use for dogs, those plastic big kennels?
Yes.
I put them in that. And then I sat there with about two or three syringes full of ketamine, that if any one of those chimps tried to even get out of their boxes, I was going to, you know, smack them again with some ketamine to keep them down, because there was nothing between us and the pilots. So if a chimp did get out and freaked out, all of us could go down for sure. But the pilot and co-pilot both knew that risk, and we were all willing to take that risk.
But it worked. You got all the chimps out.
Yeah, we got
them
all out. They were perfect little angels, and it's like they almost knew, you know, just to sit there, and then drive them then to the Nairobi orphanage, and they had to stay there for a month. And
do you mean
an animal
orphanage,
which is very close to Wilson Airport. And it was only when we got to the orphanage that all the chimps had just had enough, and they all broke out of their boxes all at the same time. And I had to sort of walk into the holding area where they were going to be with like this massive chimps all clinging to me.
Was it around about this time, Debbie, you got malaria?
Yes, I did. That was a month later, because I had to do quarantine for 1 month in Nairobi. And when I got back to do that, I'm like sitting in the enclosure feeling not so great. And I sort of said to everyone, I said, if I ever got the flu or I've got malaria at this stage, I don't know which one it is. But I just sort of went down very, very quick. And that was my first experience of malaria.
Were you lucky to survive that bout of malaria?
Yeah, they always say that your first bout is always the worst. You know, it really does hit you. And I had actually hopped on a plane and gone down to Zimbabwe because I have relatives in Zimbabwe, and I was meeting my mother in Zimbabwe. So poor old mum comes to the airport with my aunt to pick me up, and I say, I've either got the flu or I've got malaria. We'll probably know by tonight which one it is. And there's poor old mum, you know, just arrived in Africa, and the next thing is she's got a daughter shaking and, you know, not able to stand up or anything. And the next thing is I'm in hospital, and then I had to spend 5 days in hospital with quinine drip. And then finally, my hand blew up from the quinine, so they took me off that and just put me on oral quinine. So it wasn't a pleasant experience. Quinine's not very nice, you know. It swells up your liver, and so your diaphragm is right up against your lungs, so it's difficult to breathe. You feel nauseous, you know, you got diarrhea. I mean, everything that you could possibly have all at once, you're having it, terrible headaches, and that's just not a pleasant experience.
Did you for one moment think, right, that's it, I'm going back to Taronga Zoo?
No. Never.
Not for one moment.
No. I had too much work to do.
Debbie, when did you actually come face-to-face with the hard military realities of that war in Burundi?
On day two, I arrived into Burundi with a lot of supplies for the staff. And three of the staff members had asked the next day, the second day, if they could take all of their stuff that I'd got them home. And because we finished late, they asked if we would give them a lift down the road, which is about 10 kilometres out of town, and then they'd walk up the mountains to their villages and then return to work the next day. So Ali and I, who was the co-director, Ali Wood, we agreed to do that, and we drove out of town and out of the city limits, and we sort of knew that something wasn't quite right, because normally in any African country, and particularly in high-density populations like Burundi, there'd be hundreds of people walking on the side of the road, and there'd be dogs and goats and bicycles and everything. And there was nobody. There was nothing on the road, and all the houses were shut up. They didn't even see a goat on the side of the road. And we sort of knew something was wrong, but we were just, I think, naive or oblivious to what was going on. And so we continued to drive. And as we got further down and still nobody on the sides of the road, we came into visual contact with one of the security gates where there was military manning one of the boom gates. And Ali stopped at that point and just sort of asked the guys to get out and walk through the gates themselves and then up into their villages. And the guys got out of the car and came around to the side to Ali's window and talked to her in Kirundi. And she was fluent both in Kirundi and in French. And they asked her if we would drive them through the gate because they were nervous of the military. They being Hutu, and most of the military are Tutsi, so they were somewhat nervous. And so we thought, oh, that's fine, not a problem. So we told the guys to hop back in the car. And then we proceeded towards the gate and the roadblock, and we didn't get probably 200 metres before the military just jumped out at us. And, of course, you had to stop, and they dragged our staff out of the back of the car, and they tried to drag both Ali and I out of the vehicle, but both of us had our seatbelts on, so we couldn't be dragged out. And then there was just all this screaming going on. We could see that our guys were on the ground with AK-47 nozzles at the back of their heads, and everyone was just screaming. And at that point, it was sort of like you're standing in the middle of this going, oh, my God. And I just went like a big lump. I didn't do anything. I didn't say anything. I just sat there, and Ali did all the talking because her French was far more fluent, and she was very good. She stayed very calm and just kept saying and repeating the same thing over and over and over again, saying that, you know, we're the chefs of these people, which were the bosses. We're just taking them home. We work for this organization. What's the problem? And she just kept saying and saying and saying till finally the guys who were screaming at us stopped screaming and started listening and stopped trying to drag us out of the car. And then by this time they'd got our guys up off the road and just had them standing on the side but still guns pointed at them, and they were obviously all looking very nervous. At that point, Ali and I sort of knew that they told us to then leave, like they asked us to leave. And we sort of looked at each other and sort of said, well, if we leave, they could kill them. If we stay, would that keep them alive, or do they then kill all of us? at that point, they had not ever targeted any white people. So we sort of felt confident that they wouldn't be that stupid to go and kill two white women, you know, at a roadblock right now. But, you know, when everything's so tense, I mean, who knows what can happen. So in the end, we agreed to leave the men, though we weren't very happy with it. But to do that, we had to drive up and then turn around and come back. And so by the time we had found somewhere to turn around and come back, the situation seemed a lot more relaxed. And we stopped the car again. We sort of said, is everything okay? And they said, yes, yes, everything's okay. And they said, well, you can take them now. So we said, okay, put them back in the car. So we told the guys all to get in the car. We turned around and drove them back. But by this time, you know, it was getting dark, so we needed to drive them all the way to the village, which is going up into the mountains, and it's getting dark. And we're driving a Land Rover that's green, so it now looks like a military vehicle. And we just found out from the guys that the military had just been through all of these villages killing people. And so everybody up there was nervous, you know, military are all on tenterhooks, so it wasn't a good situation for anybody. So we got the guys out and said, never again, you know, we're not giving you lifts back here again. And then we got out of that area very, very quickly, driving down as quickly as we can so that people could see that we were not military. Got back to home and had a couple of beers very quickly. Yeah, that was our... That was the first sort of experience that things were a lot different, and the rules of the game was very, very different in Burundi to the country that I had been in a year ago, and that I needed to be smart if you were going to stay alive in that situation. I had a similar incident in Rwanda not long after the RPF took over Rwanda. Again, they were very nervous and very tense, and we turned up to one of these roadblocks where we had one of the soldiers who I'm not sure, he wasn't drunk, but I think he was high on drugs, and he was extremely aggressive. And we ended up being stuck there for about an hour, and I just had to continue talking to him to appease him and get him to let us go. But, you know, he basically wanted to drag us all off into the bush and shoot us all. We had a friend who was a driver, was a very big Yorkshire man, and he was creating the tension because of his size and him being male. So I had to get him to go and sit in the car and be quiet. And then I just kept talking and kept offering, you know, they wanted to see what was in our car, which we, you know, allowed them to do it, but he just didn't think we did it quick enough. So that was enough for him. So any excuse that he could make to create an aggressive situation is what he was doing. And they always had two soldiers at that time. They had always an English speaker and a French speaker. And this guy was the English speaker, and he was the one who was completely off his head. And the other guy was a French speaker. So I was, of course, appeasing to the French speaker that, you know, come on, you know, what's going on here? You can see that, you know, it's him, it's not us. But he was also nervous of his own colleague as well. So it was a matter of just, you have to just stay calm, and you have to show submission without showing fear. And that's something that you learn when you work with dangerous animals. And so my animal training definitely helped me out in those situations. I think it's in my nature to be calm, but definitely animal training, you know, working with them. I mean, I've had situations where someone forgot to close the door, and, you know, I walk into a holding area that's got a snow leopard in it, and there's nothing between me and the snow leopard, that they forgot to close the door. And so you're standing there looking at the leopard, it's looking at me, and you have to stay calm to make the leopard realize there is nothing wrong. So it stays where it is, and you can calmly close the door to have a separation between you and them. And the same thing has happened with the chimps as well, with the adult chimps. And so you know, you learn to have to not react. But at the same time, as I said, sometimes you have to be able to show submission, and you have to do that like with wild chimps and wild gorillas, particularly wild gorillas. You must show submission to them if they're charging at you. Dropping down and putting your head down and letting them go over the top of you, and often they'll thump you on your back or drag you by the leg down the hill a little bit before they let you go, and you have to be a rag doll through all of that process. You never fight back. You just go with the flow.
How did you go about getting started again, all over again, in Uganda, Debbie?
I was actually prepared to go back to Taronga after Burundi. I'd sort of think, okay, I've had my go, I've had a chance, you know, I'll just go back. But then the Institute persuaded me to go into Uganda. At that time, I sort of wasn't sure about the political situation, and that was of major concern to me because I'd just gone through a country where I'd been there in 93 where they were under a military dictatorship and everything was calm and functioned very well, thank you very much. Give them democratic elections and two assassinated presidents later, you know, it's just chaos and, you know, genocide going on. Uganda in 96 was having their first ever elections and I just went, I don't want to do this again.
And this Uganda who'd been through Idi Amin and Milton Obote.
Yeah, that's right. And Museveni had been running it pretty much as a dictatorship for like 10, 12 years and was now prepared to do elections. And I was just thinking, you know, if they go belly up the same way Burundi just did, I don't know if I want to do it again. So when they asked me to go, I went in and spent a weekend. And I actually just walked around the streets a lot asking Ugandans what they thought was going to happen when the elections came. And they just said, we're tired of war. You know, we just want to have a home. We want to be able to put our kids through school. We just want peace. So whatever happens, we're going to deal with it. You know, we're not going backwards in this process.
And is that largely what's actually happened in Uganda?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's quite stable these days.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's the big difference. They had suffered enough that they realised that war was not going to give them what they wanted. The Burundians haven't got to that stage yet. It's still tit for tat fighting. It's still a lot of personal family vendettas against others, and which escalates into a national conflict. And until they get to that point that they really are prepared for peace at whatever cost that's going to be, they're never going to have it. Where the Ugandans already got there, they'd had enough of it. They had 20 years of not having peace and now they wanted peace. So they were going to make it happen no matter what. So I was prepared to, you know, stick it out with them than if they were prepared to really accept peace.
You discovered those the chimps in Entebbe Zoo. What condition were those chimpanzees in?
Their physical condition and psychological condition was very good, but the environment that they were living in was dreadful. You know, it was definitely third world enclosures, very unsuitable for them. It took me 2 weeks of cleaning their walls to get back down to the original paint. You know, I don't think they had been cleaned probably in several years.
Was that part of the job description when you took on the gig?
Absolutely.
Well, that's
part of it, and teaching the local people to do their job properly. I had a colleague with me, Anthony Dorian from Taronga Zoo. We spent a day what we call rat bashing. We killed 20 rats in a session.
How do you kill the rats?
Generally just hit them with a stick. We sort of enclose ourselves into the room and then you just go for it.
Whack with a stick.
Yeah.
Were these like the chimps you were dealing with in Burundi? Were they orphans?
Yeah, they're all orphans. They'd all gone through the same thing. And it was really interesting because a lot of those chimps had been confiscated during Idi Amin's era, even Milton Obote's era. So it's actually quite interesting that law and order seemed to still be present and that police and customs officials were still doing their jobs.
When you say confiscated, what do you mean?
Well, normally if somebody's trying to bring, as I said, pretty much all of the chimps came from Congo. Again, Ugandans don't go around killing chimps. Very few of the chimps that were in the sanctuary now actually originate from Uganda. Most of them at that time all came from the Congo. And the Congolese are bringing them across the border to trade them, to sell them. And normally they're trying to trade with a middle trader who's then sending them to the coast.
What for? As pets or bushmeat?
Yeah, they're going. No, mainly for pets at this stage. And if they can get them into the Middle East, that man, the end product, is getting about $30,000 an individual. So it's a lucrative illegal market, and it's normally the same guys involved in illegal wildlife trade are also involved in illegal arms trade and illegal drugs. You know, it's all the same. It's the same group who do all three, you know, and often wildlife is used particularly for drug shipments.
So, Debbie, with the chimps in the zoo, why not have them released into the wild? Was that possible, or is it just impossible if they've been
in Uganda? It's not impossible to release chimps. Chimps can go back to the wild. But what you need is a forest that's big enough to house an extra 20, 30, 40 chimps to the population you already have. If there are no chimps in the forest that you're releasing them to, you would ask the question, why? If it was suitable for chimps, why aren't chimps there? So normally the logical question would be that they've been hunted out or disease has gone through there somehow for them not to be there. So you need to make sure you don't put added pressure on a population of wild chimpanzees by adding more individuals if the carrying capacity is at maximum. And in any wildlife situation, you have to consider that unless disease or hunting, overhunting, has depleted the population should be at carrying capacity, because that's normal to be always at carrying capacity.
So you don't want them in the zoo, really,
no.
And you don't want them necessarily in the wild either. So what was the solution?
Was a sanctuary to give them a natural environment that's the same as what they had, but it's a controlled environment. And that's what the islands were able to offer us, was we could give them a natural forest. We would still have to supplement feed them because it wouldn't be a big enough forest for them to fend for themselves. But they would be protected and humans would be protected. By being on an island, the chimps couldn't escape. And so local people living around the chimps aren't in danger as well. I mean, chimps are 8 times stronger than people. When they're being habituated to people, they're not afraid of people.
So 8 times
stronger than humans. Yeah. And so, you know, they can be scary.
Having set these sanctuaries up, these have now become major tourist destinations in Uganda. What kind of tourist experience do people have? Can they actually walk in and have physical contact with some of these chimps?
Well, there's normally three ways that you can do it. You can either just come for a day visit and you see the chimps coming out of the forest and receiving food either in the morning or the afternoon. And that's, I think that's pretty good. We sort of get the message across, but I sometimes feel that people walk away like congratulating you and say, God, you guys have done a great job and, you know, that's it, I don't have to do any more. But, you know, these animals have to live there for the rest of their lives. And it's a 50-60 year commitment for the trust and the sanctuary in order to look after them. And it costs money. You know, you have to pay salaries, you've got to buy food, and all of that costs money. We started doing a forest walk, and I was not sure whether that was a good thing to do, whether it would send out the wrong message. But interesting enough, the forest walk allows maximum four people a day to come with us when we take the younger chimps for a walk in the forest. And that's more about getting them assimilated to the forest and also starting to integrate them with the adults. And we can go in with all the adult females even today. They're very stable and it's not a problem. So we would let them have that opportunity because we considered the people not to be interfering. They were like added attraction and enrichment for the chimps. And once they're out in the forest, they really don't worry about you so much. They're playing in the trees, they're doing their thing, but you get that close exposure to them. And people walk away with a much more understanding of what it's all about.
That's what you're all about, isn't it, Rue? This is why you do what you do, to effect that greater understanding.
Yeah, and for people to make a lifetime commitment to whatever it is, whether you like lions or whether you like whales or like anything, it shouldn't be a one-off, okay, I did my bit. You know, this is a lifetime commitment. You know, if we're going to protect these endangered species or protected areas, it takes a lifetime commitment to do that. And once someone has that one-to-one connection, you can't walk away.
Debbie Cox, it's been great meeting you. Thank you so much for being with me in conversation today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.